It's Wednesday evening, so you know what that means.
Sounds to me like I'm not even supposed to be here today, Brad.
Regardless, my friend, the pod marches on. It is time for the Sucks Podcast. I'm your host, Brad.
And I'm your host, Dave.
And this is a podcast where we talk about design, intentional and otherwise, and all the ways that UX,
user experience design,
impact us every day. And we are lovers, not experts of UX design. We started this podcast as a way to talk about why things were made the way that they are.
And where those design decisions might have gone off the rails.
David, we don't have producer Joe today. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, Brad. You know, this is a nighttime episode. I don't know how my nighttime brain works. Usually I got all the juice in the morning, you know?
Dude, I think I'm a completely different person after like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We'll see.
Yeah, I don't know. Let's jump into it. Do we have any banter?
Oh, you know, we should talk about Ticketmaster.
I wanted to talk about Twitter, but we could talk about Twitter. Ticketmaster.
Yeah.
What do you want to talk about for Ticketmaster, Brad?
I mean, Ticketmaster is in the news. The Taylor Swift debacle is now nationwide news. There's new calls to break up the Ticketmaster monopoly. All of this we covered in detail on our Ticketmaster episode. So I just wanted to remind people that they need to go back and listen to that episode for the full breakdown on why Ticketmaster sucks, because we predicted all of this.
Yeah, I believe that's a call to action, Brad. That's what you're doing there.
Right?
It's
a mandatory call to action. It's in the script.
If this was a website, there'd be a big button right on Brad's head. I wanted to talk about Twitter, but I'm not going to. We're going to say this is a fun, lighthearted episode, and I don't want to get that to that angry place. Like, there's a lot going on in that corner of the universe. We'll save it for next week. We'll save for next week, Brad. I don't want to bring us down. Oh, you want to talk about Mastodon?
Well, I mean, it's too early to really say too much about Mastodon for me, but I did apply for one of these servers on Mastodon. It's a very strange experience.
Same.
And I was accepted this morning into one of them, but I haven't really played around with it. But I do find it incredibly clunky.
Yeah. Yeah. So finding a server. So for our users who don't know, who haven't made the leap yet to other platforms outside of Twitter, Mastodon is user based. Like, it's you. Everybody can have their own server. I tried to join a server and I signed up and everything. And then I just got a big Mastodon logo that said forbidden. So it's like, that's it. Like, it was like, no, it was like, it felt like a game where you just don't know the riddle, right? Like, let's talk like a Zelda or something. I don't know. I'm trying to tie it in. And it's just a big X. It just said no. It didn't give me any indication. Bad user experience, Brad. It didn't tell me username is taken. It didn't say server is full. Just told me nothing. So
very strange. For our listeners, our users who don't know, Mastodon is meant to be a competitor or a successor to Twitter for those people who don't want to be on Twitter platform for very valid and obvious reasons. So anyway, more to come on all this stuff, but let's keep on trucking.
Yeah, let's save that for another episode.
You got any cool shit to talk about, Dave?
It's the cool shit. It's the cool shit. It's the cool shit.
It's old people telling you what's cool.
Yeah, Brad, I think I got a couple things. So look,
good.
This is an evening episode. I didn't want to do my research. I read these articles a couple days ago, but we have to do it. And here's why. Because we have a special guest today. And these two things tie into the special guest, oddly, serendipitously, I might add.
Go on.
Yeah. So the first one, MIT Technology Review. There's a company called Colossal Biosciences, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to read a sentence that makes no sense to me, but it shows you that I if I did read it correctly, it would make it sound like I knew what I was talking about. So if these folks can make a Dunart cell with enough thylus in DNA, the next step is to use the cloning to make an embryo and eventually an animal. Mm-hmm. So Brad, what is this about? Okay. They're trying to bring back species that are extinct. This is, what is this, Brad?
Cool shit.
No, you jumped right to it. No, Brad, it is cool shit. But this is like Jurassic Park. I mean, they're actually doing it now. So they're trying to take these cells. They're adding some genes to it, right? They don't have resurrected species yet. Yeah, okay.
But
what they're doing is they're using a combination of a high-tech combo of DNA technology, stem cell research, gene editing, artificial wombs.
And the resting DNA of a bullfrog.
Exactly. And you know what? Somehow, life finds a way.
Life finds a way. So just to make it, you know, completely a through line for this entire episode, I read the article. You know what they're trying to bring back?
What are they trying to bring back?
A motherfucking mastodon.
Uh-huh. Oh, look at what. This is weird. I feel like the universe is going to collapse because everything's tying together into this episode. You're right. They are. This is. And OK, here's the thing, Brad. And the best part, what are they going to do with it? How are they going to pay for it?
This they're going to put it to work. They're going to give it a job at the mall at Spencer's Gifts until it pays for itself.
Close. They're going to turn a profit by selling tickets to see it. What does that sound like?
Not cool shit to me.
No. And we're talking 2 years, Brad, 2025 and a woolly mammoth by 2027.
Oh, gosh.
All right. And the other thing I have, Brad.
Modern day Prometheus.
The other thing I just did absolutely no reading on. I'm just going to read the headline because we'll get back to it when you introduce our one of our guests. The ex-president of Elon Musk's Neuralink has new brain computer startup. So that's all I got. That is in the that's in Bloomberg. Go ahead and Google that and read it for yourself, users.
That sounds like it potentially could be some cool shit.
Indeed.
Why don't we take a quick break and we will come back with our main topic, which is video game console UX with two special guests. And we're back with our main topic, video game consoles and user experience, with our two special guests. The first guest is a first chair trombonist and euphonium player at Orange County School of the Arts, and a procrastinator on his college applications and taking out the garbage as well. He is a lifelong gamer, though, and the son to one of the hosts of this podcast who is not me, Liam Walsh. Welcome to the pod. How you doing?
Hello, I'm doing great. I feel great to be on this podcast, and I'm excited to talk about video game design.
We needed a bona fide current gamer to join us for this very important discussion, and that's you, right?
Yeah.
Right on. Well, thanks for joining us.
And our returning guest today is a writer and producer for games and television, former interactive executive at Netflix and Disney, and is a writer now on a new Star Wars series called Young Jedi Adventures. And thus, he is living all of our personal hopes and dreams.
True story.
His latest credit, the interactive Netflix release Jurassic World Camp Cry, can't pronounce, Brad?
Well, I mean, I guess he could help us, but I think it's Cretaceous.
Camp Criminy, I think, is actually the – no. Camp Cretaceous.
Cretaceous. Camp Cretaceous, Hidden Adventure, dropped just last week as we record this. Congratulations, Julius. In addition, and most important to this episode, in 1997, he won a Nintendo Power contest to design a video game console of the future. Julius Harper, welcome back to the pod. How you doing?
Hey, hey, hey. Doing good.
So happy to have you back, man. Thanks for joining us.
So good to be back.
Yes, I think we need like a two-timers award, a robe or a hat or so.
Do I get like a small little achievement unlocked? Like a little thing?
I think so. I think we have, are there two people now or three people that have returned?
We have three people who have been on the pod twice. Okay. Now, I do think that we need some swag for the third timers club. I don't think two, I'm sorry, Julius, doesn't quite cut it. But for the third time, I am thinking embroidered bathrobes or something like that.
Nice.
A la SNL, right? Yeah.
That's right. Okay. And we're a lot has changed, Julius, since season one and the last time you were on. I mean, we were recording in our homes back then. It was the pandemic. And now we're in our swanky new studio. Which you can see here. And, our financial situation has changed. Now the ad revenue is flowing in. It's
living the dream
vibe. So yes, I hope you don't mind the gold, the diamonds, and all that stuff. We're still, at the end of the day, a down-to-earth podcast. Thank you for joining us.
No, for sure. Definitely.
Alrighty. So we're going to keep on trucking and talk about our personal experiences as gamers, our bona fides as gamers. I'll start. I've been a gamer for since I was 5. I think even before that, I had an Atari 2600. And then the Nintendo NES that I got in 1987 changed my life for sure. I was a hardcore Nintendo kid. As I entered my teens, I became a more of a Sega kid. I had the Genesis, and then nothing until then. I skipped a generation, I think, and then I got the Dreamcast when I was in college. Oh,
the Dreamcast. Whoa. Rest in peace.
I still think that it is one of the greatest consoles ever, and I mean that sincerely. It was wonderful.
Sonic Adventure.
Yeah, man. And then fast forward, I did develop video games, some of them with Julius here at Disney, which we'll get into a little bit. And today, I'm a father and an old man, and I play casually with my kid. I help her sometimes with her Roblox, and I play the Xbox One, and I have a PS4, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But anyway, that's it. Let's go to Liam. Liam, how long have you been a gamer, and what are you playing?
Man, my whole life. Since I was like 4, thanks to my wonderful father, I got my hands on a Game Boy Advance, and I started playing games like Metroid Fusion, Super Mario Advance, all that.
Fusion.
And that was
dropping with the bombs right away. Exactly. Metroid Fusion is a great game.
It is a great game, and it was my first introduction. So grateful for it. Introduced me to Metroid, and from there, I just always play Nintendo. You know, I got into Mario, Kirby, all the series. And then, of course, as my parents loosened restrictions on the internet, I could play like food games.
Watch yourself, counselor.
Yeah, easy.
Yeah. I think some of the first Steam games I played on PC were like Undertale and Terraria.
Oh, Undertale. Okay. Yes.
Very good games. And I think that in turn introduced me to like one of my favorite games, Earthbound. And I got more into RPGs and all that now. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. Games I'm playing recently, like this summer, I actually finished Sonic Adventure 1 and 2, talking about the Dreamcast, for the first time.
Whoa, old school.
I know. Played it on a PC. But I should go back, do some more missions. Right now, I'm playing an RPG called Lisa the Painful. Very painful. Harsh story. Very, a lot of moral stuff. But cool. It's very cool. It. And then I think past that, I'm going to start playing Kirby and the Forgotten Land on Nintendo Switch.
Yeah, I would like to jump in here, son. I'd like to jump in here and note about how concerned you are about your achievements in a video game, how you should go back and work on that. Yet I don't see the same type of concern about your college applications.
Because I got it under control. You know, it's too easy for college applications, but video games, they're a bit harder. It's like... They're a bit harder, you know. I swear to you.
See that right there, right? It's harder to do the video games, so it's more worthwhile to do them. That's the gamer college mentality.
Yeah, college applications. Well, maybe, you know, you just go through the applications, like, man, okay, I just told some people about my life, but like,
maybe we need to gamify. Maybe we need to gamify the college application process.
Of course, you got to give me a score.
I think there's some heavy psychographics in what you just described, Liam, around maybe Skinner boxes and things like that, that, you know, kind of create these conflicts in video games. Anyway, that's not what we're talking about today. But Dave, how about you? Do you want to talk about your experience with video games?
Yeah, I mean, I'm noticing a trend here. A lot of Nintendo kids here. This is kind of interesting. I was strictly a Nintendo kid. You know, I it's funny. I had a best friend. Probably doesn't listen to this pod, so he had everything first. He was that kid on the block, right. So he had an Atari when Ataris were still new. That's how old I am, right? And I was so jealous of this guy. I was at his place all the time playing. And then when he got a Nintendo was when I got my first Atari. Right. So I was
right. That's, he was always one lag. Generation or step ahead.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. So you know, so I made the leap from Atari, which I loved. I mean, you know, I played some games that people, you know, my favorite game is one that is everyone in the world hates except me. Can you guess what it is? What is the most hated Atari game on the planet?
Yes.
The E.T. game.
I love the E.T. game. I don't know what it was. It was the charm of, I think, E.T. the movie just kind of like descending into my brain as I played it.
It's the bias.
when he would, yeah, there was a bias. So when he fell into that pit and he had to like lengthen his neck, random, that's such a weird, like, is that right. power he had Strange in the movie? Power. I don't remember that. Yeah.
The only game mechanic, by the way.
Yes. And he would just climb out of the thing. I would feel for him. And every time I fell back in the pit, I was frustrated, but I would want to get him out of there. So, yeah. So that was a TARDIS for
us. That's the power of fandom and franchise right there.
Yeah. It's the mind part of it. Like, the game might be bad, but what your mind is doing, it's kind of like Lewis's design.
So I still have very warm feelings about that game. To hear people trash it just hurts right here, Brad.
I'm not even sure that E.T. is a good movie.
No. How dare you?
Oh, okay.
Shots fired.
And that's the sound of Brad being excommunicated from the pod.
Thank God. Finally, I've been trying to get fired from this podcast for a year.
So, Julius, I hope you have some friends, or if you'd like to join the pod, there's an opening. I mean, I don't know if this Star Wars and Jurassic Park writing thing is going anywhere, but, you know, there's definitely a spot.
I mean, after talking smack about E.T., I figure, like, you know, it could only go up from here. Come on, man.
Right. All right. No, it's a well-crafted film, but I have some issues. We'll save it for another episode here.
Yeah, let me finish my user journey here, Brad.
Okay.
So I moved into Nintendo, and then I played everything Nintendo. I still remember that little robot and the gun, Robbie. You know, with the ducks.
Wow. Yeah. The zapper.
Yep. And my
the
favorite
power
thing.
Glove.
Thank you, Liam.
I had a power glove.
Yes. Red! And the amazing so thing for bad. Me about Nintendo is how Nintendo, there's such industry drivers. Like, they were always ahead of their time. And it's like the power glove
didn't work.
Google Glass. Yep. It was ahead of its time, and we haven't gotten the right Google Glass, but we will someday. But the Power Glove basically is the Wii, right? And it's the Switch. It's all those things that we have now. But I love the Power Glove. I mean, I think I spent more time running around pretending to be like a cyborg with it from Star Wars or something, sure. Right? than I did actually playing a game with it.
Totally.
But yeah, I mean, and Metroid, Liam talked about loving Metroid. That comes directly from my love of Metroid. It's like one of my favorite game franchises. And fun story about that. We handed him a console. We would go to his sister's, you know, when you're having a baby, you go every week to the lady doctor. That's a terrible term. What do you call it?
Technical term.
Yeah.
Gynecologist.
Doesn't matter because it's not saying in the podcast.
Went to one of them lady doctors.
Wait, a lady doctor?
Lady doctor.
Is that allowed?
I just don't know the term. It's not just gynecologist. There's an
obstetrician.
OBGYN. Thank you.
OBGYN.
So I had to go to the OBGYN, and I was a good husband. I went to every single appointment. But the funny thing was,
I've never known you to be a good husband.
But that's true. But Brad, don't tell anybody. Okay. Her OBGYN was in Beverly Hills, and it was like this pristine office.
Humble brag.
Like, the tables were glass. Like, everything seemed to be made out of glass. And Liam was like a bull in a china shop, like almost quite literally. So she said, oh, why don't you give him like a gaming system or something? And that was the start of something beautiful and terrible because the kid never stopped playing ever since. In fact, he was yelling at me to get on the pod because he was playing a game.
I was having my cousin play a game. There was a difference.
I got it. I'm sorry. I took a lot of time. Julius, our star guest here, we need to hear your journey with video game consoles.
Oh, man. Yeah. So I guess it's a similar story. Also, a Nintendo kid. I had a Game Gear for a hot second when I was young, but it was mostly Nintendo for me from the start. I had the original Game Boy, which was the big blocky one with the spinach green screen. There was no color,
dude. That thing
back in
beautiful.
My day. I still have it somewhere here.
The same one?
I could dig it up.
The OG one?
The OG Whoa. One, yeah.
Wow.
I played Super Mario Land, the original, Super Mario Land 2, 6 Golden Coins. I was big, big, big into Mario.
Yeah.
Just like from the start. I think that my first console was probably the NES that came with Super Mario Brothers 3, which... I don't know if you guys remember.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the day, no save option. Okay.
Yes.
So if you don't beat that game in like a sitting, you're done. Like, it's over.
Yes, sir.
And I don't know if you guys remember, if you play it all the way through without using the warp whistles, the game will overheat in like world 5. So you actually have to pause and not play the game for 20 minutes to let it cool down a little
bit. I did not know this.
I kept getting to the Sky World, I think it was, where you go up the little tower and half the world is in the sky. Yeah. It's the thing with the boot that you would jump around in.
Yeah,
I had the game freeze multiple times in that world because it overheated.
Ouch, lag.
And you can imagine after putting hours of work into getting to that point, and then it just... And then just like it just starts flashing the little red light. So
I feel privileged playing the GBA port of that because you could at least save, but Mario 3 without saving, that's kind of otherworldly. I should try it sometimes.
And Liam, that's what I tell you all the time when I yell at my son for not getting off his games. I'm like, when I was your age, we had to play to the end or else it wouldn't save.
Did you have online play? Could you always pause?
Oh no!
Now it's equal.
Okay, all right. Touche. Touche.
Okay, we've been recording for like 4 hours, and we have not started the episode yet. I suggest we keep going.
Let's let Julius finish his.
I'll finish up the nerd journey really fast. So went from NES, never had a Super Nintendo, really wanted one, didn't get one. Mm-hmm. Got the N64. Got really, really, really into a game called Super Smash Brothers. And to this day, I remain like a very, if there's a game that I'm hardcore about, it's the Smash Brothers series. Yeah. I've played in tournaments. Okay. Whoa. Like that's the thing where I'm like, all of your favorite IP across the whole entire Nintendo pantheon and others, you just duke it out and it's really, really great.
I'm very bad at it. I'm not a good Smash player, so I might have to hit you up for some tips or something.
But I am here for you. Yes.
What do you mean?
Oh, a fox, of now. Course.
Fox. All right. Yeah, I'm a Game & Watch main because I'm a silly guy.
Game & Watch, nice.
I'm a silly guy, man. Oh,
fun fact, Julius, Liam is an avid collector of Game & Watches, vintage Game & Watches.
Until you stopped paying me allowance, nice. But I used to, I wanted to get an allowance.
Until you stopped doing work.
Where you didn't pay me and I lost interest, but you know, we're past that now.
All right. Okay. So listen, we Julius, everybody has told their nerd journey. Okay, Brad?
Yes. Okay. We have nerded it out successfully.
Are you ready to lead us into the episode?
Okay. So as a reminder, we are not talking about just games here, and we're actually not talking about games at all. We're talking about the game systems themselves, the consoles in which we play these, which have their own onboard UX and UI. That is the primary focus of this discussion today. And to start, as we are apt to do, we're going to start with some personas, user personas. And it would be really easy to stray heavily into stereotyping here. And really, as you guys know, personas are a form of stereotyping, useful ones, though, I would say. We'll do our best here.
Well, Brad, hold on. Before I go, are you setting me up for a trap again? Because often you like work it out so that I land on a persona that embarrasses me.
No, not this time.
No setup?
Seriously.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I just didn't have that kind of time to put that level of thought into the script this week.
No inception. You're safe.
I'm going to let you start. I'm choosing.
Thank you.
I can't. Okay.
Okay, so we can go round robin here. Julius, would you like to take one of these two?
Michelle self-identifies as a hardcore gamer. She's 32 and has a good job with some disposable income. She plays an FPS called Destiny 2 with the same group of friends at least 4 nights a week as a primary social interaction. When there's a new console, PlayStation for Michelle, she will pre-order. She is far more than a customer. She is a fan to a piece of hardware and to a brand.
Robbie is a father in his early 40s. Robbie plays games as stress relief or when he's bored. He usually will have the last generation of consoles. He's not in a rush to upgrade. He plays mostly sports and racing games when he has the time. He sees an ad for Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, a game with a very similar title to a game he played religiously 10 years ago, and he decides to buy it partially out of nostalgia. He is surprised with the amount of friction and decisions required to purchase and install and play this game. This is a player who will churn out of the premium game experience at some point soon.
Chloe is Robbie's 10-year-old daughter. She plays Roblox every day with friends on her iPad. She is aware that Roblox and more sophisticated games are found on gaming consoles. She has no interest in AAA games and looks at gaming as immersive social experiences not built on or requiring bleeding edge graphics and hardware.
Right on. And we could develop, you know, 20 more of these personas, but to start, let's go with that in the interest of time. And we'll jump into some user requirements next. User requirements. First, as a hardcore gamer, I want to play the latest and greatest releases in the best quality possible. Julius, are you able to take the next one?
Yeah, as a hardcore gamer and maybe a PC gamer as well, right? I want to use my gaming system to optimize my experience towards game mastery, customizing my button layout and prioritizing things like frame rate, which may give me a competitive advantage.
As a casual gamer, I want to pick up and play quickly without a lot of fuss.
And as a user, I want to purchase games and manage my gaming library simply and intuitively.
As a user, I may want my game console to perform as a media or home entertainment hub as a secondary use case.
So people want these consoles to do different things. So I would like to describe next a user journey that I recently experienced just this last week relating to gaming system hardware specifically. So here's my journey based on me purchasing God of War Ragnarok for my PlayStation 4, which is the previous generation of consoles. So here it is. As a consumer, I made a decision to purchase a AAA game after seeing uniformly great reviews. I have to make a decision to purchase digital or physical media. In this case, randomly, I chose to purchase a disc in person from a retailer, which is something that I never do. After my kid is put to bed, I decide to fire up the game. Even though I insert physical media, the system UI prompts me to download the full game. This is a mandatory feature. The disc itself is seemingly used only for DRM, which is digital rights management. That essentially, the disc is a key that just verifies that I own the game, but there's very little data on the actual disc itself, which I would say is kind of sucky. I began to download a 107 gigabyte file, which takes several hours. During this time, when I wanted to be playing, I searched my library for a game that I can pick up and play during this nonsense. After the game is installed, I am then prompted for a day one patch, which takes more time, about 25 minutes in my experience. I realize during this time that I will realistically not start this game until the following day. Eventually, the next day, I play the game and enjoy it, but I do question whether it's worth the time, friction, and expense. I immediately regret my decision to purchase physical media, even though I can trade in that game to offset the cost. That is my user journey just this week in 2022 of buying a AAA game.
Sounds terrible,
I would say that it was rough.
Yeah.
Mm. I remember you complaining about this, Brad. You were texting us all about this, and it just sounded god-awful. Like, what is the point of the physical media?
It's a key. It's a token. That's it. So what I was doing, guys, Liam and Julius, I was texting producer Joe and Dave screenshots of my television screen with the load bar.
Yeah, it sounds fun. Those games. I like how I mentioned Roblox, because like I know that even Roblox now, they front load it with so much like graphics stuff. And it's like it's hard to run even on like slower devices. And it's just like, really? Man. Yeah, even because like, even games, it doesn't. I don't know. I have opinions about Roblox because of how they monetize things and stuff. But
Yeah, well, it sounds like it sounds like you're jumping right into our next topic, which is pain points.
Ah, perfect.
That's right.
So should I continue?
Go ahead, Liam. What are your pain points with these systems?
Yeah, basically, like even Roblox, when like games don't require that level of like I don't know quality and graphics, it's like. They still try to front load it with that stuff. And I feel like it's just that status of games and like how they constantly aim for that top-notch quality, and that can be burdensome for people who just want a game casually. And I like how we have like these personas to kind of represent that. Because like sometimes games just aren't all about the graphics, and sometimes you can't even run the graphics, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that Roblox is not worth the amount of time. The graphics don't justify the upfront difficulty to just jump into the game.
Exactly.
It's not like you're playing like Call of Duty or Destiny or, you know, Cyberpunk.
You see some of these games have like insane graphics, but then you see like a vast majority are just blocky stuff. And I don't even play Roblox anymore, but like if I just want to open like a game for fun, like it's just how they render the graphics, and it's kind of like, is it worth it? Is it really worth it? It's Roblox. Right.
Yeah, I think you're describing a disconnect between, you know, games as something you can pick up and play and just have fun with versus something you have to put, serious expenditure of time and energy in just to play a game once, which is certainly my user journey with God of War. But, you know, to start with, the reason why these consoles are still successful is because the companies do a really great job at cultivating fan bases.
Oh, yeah.
Each of these consoles, PlayStation, Nintendo, Xbox, and PC, have diehard fan bases that they will go to the mat for each of these consoles, which is, to me, kind of in the abstract, bizarre. Because these are devices to empower us to play games. Sometimes they're multi-platform or cross-platform games, so you can play a game on any console. So it's a little bizarre in the abstract to be hardcore about a console, although I do understand and in some ways am a bit of a fanboy for a couple of these. Julius, I think Nintendo does a really great job at this.
Oh, for sure.
What are your thoughts?
I mean, Nintendo is like the Disney of video games, right? When you know a Nintendo product is coming out, you're going to have a fun time. It's going to be a polished game. You're going to enjoy it. There's going to be lots of playtime in there. It's not necessarily going to push the envelope of what games are capable of doing or, you know, be super groundbreaking. But when you pick up, you know, Animal Crossing or when you pick up the next Mario game, you know you're going to have a solid amount of fun. Yeah. And their brand really banks on that. And I think to your point, you know, when you're talking about some of the other game consoles and publishers, it's a similar sort of thing. It's games are not, I guess, fungible is not the right word, but it's like they're not necessarily interchangeable. They're not the same experience all across the board. Mm-hmm. I think of, again, just going with like the Disney metaphor, when Rise of Skywalker came out and people were standing in line for that movie, or
that movie,
right? Or like, you know, Endgame, you know, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's like, right, there's something about these certain IP that go beyond just simple, I'm going to entertain myself, but it's, I identify in some meaningful way.
Right.
I derive something deeper from, you know, experiencing this particular franchise or product. And I'm willing to crawl over broken glass in order to play the new version of Animal Crossing. And so you put up with a whole lot in order to get to that space. Whereas you don't see that same sort of brand loyalty with, like, I don't know, an Angry Birds or a Cut the Rope, you know, to name some mobile games that are a decade old at this point. You know, but it's
diehard Cut the Rope fans. I'm sure they exist, you know.
Yeah, there's a couple of them. Candy. But there are people who are like, you know, when's the next Madden coming out? You know, when is the next Call of Duty coming out? And like, that's where that fandom comes from. And I think it's a confusing sort of thing to watch. Like you're saying, it's weird to see people like so into these particular IPs and put up with so much trouble to play the game. But you think about it, you know, people are laying down $500 to get a new console,
right?
Plus $60 to get the game.
$70 now.
You know, $70, they're really bought in.
Yeah.
And so that's just a completely different type of user persona versus the casual gamer who's just like, I just want to do a thing and be entertained for a little bit. It's just a completely different market.
Yeah, I find it hard to be that casual gamer anymore. I mean, even when I was a kid, let's define casual gamer, right? Mm. Like, when I was a kid, I could pick up Mario Brothers, or I could pick up Metroid, or I could pick up these games. I could play for a little bit, get to a save station, and shut it off. That never happened, right? Because you get addicted.
Yeah.
But you could do that. And I feel like now, I don't know, like, it just seems so hard to do that anymore. Like, maybe it's just because I'm older and I don't have the time. But I'll spend some, or the games have gotten harder or more complex, or I don't know what it is.
All true.
But I find it very hard to be a casual gamer, and thus I don't really play that much unless it's something like Smash Bros. What's the racing game? Mario Kart.
Mario Kart.
You know, any of those things that
party
have
games, right?
Yeah, the game. Those things I can do, but you know, to pick up the latest Metroid and devote time to it, you get to a place where you get stuck and then it's like, okay, I've got a job.
Yeah, I feel that. Right? I feel that a lot. It's kind of like the burden of playing like games, especially games where like you have to think a lot. Like I say Pokemon, because honestly with Pokemon, like you kind of have to like, now, especially now, Pokemon used to be so much more simple, but now there's all this stuff to like keep track of, and like, it's just such a wide range of stuff. And I find it hard to pick up games like those when I just really want to sit down and game casually. And I think that's kind of a interesting discussion point.
I think so too. And it's funny you mentioned Pokemon, because I was about to give Nintendo some serious props on living up to their brand promise for not having to put the user through all that nonsense that I described with God of War. However, Liam, you brought up Pokemon, and that's in the news because they shipped this broken game, which they typically don't do. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like it's Pokemon. You guys are the experts. I'm not. But is it Ruby or something? It's the most recent Pokemon game. Just came out, and it's broken.
Spaghetti people.
Which rarely happens with Nintendo.
And you know, it's that's true, because it's funny that we mentioned this this sort of like, I don't know, this like fan base and like diehard fans, because Pokemon is very known for having for releasing a game every single year, no matter what it may be. And when they don't do that, it can be seen that like fans will have an outburst. And I think what happens is like they have to sacrifice so much to live up to this goal. And like people are very pissed when like the Pokédex, like they had to like exclude some Pokemon from the game because they've stacked on this series so much. It's such a profitable series, but it becomes so hard nowadays to like constantly have to satisfy the fans without sacrificing stuff, like releasing a game every year. Or there was one year they didn't do that. I think it was between like Diamond and Pearl and Platinum. I think that was the year in which they did not release a game in the year. And so, I mean,
maybe that's what happened. Maybe that's, you know, race to the goal, you know, and then I mean, the video game industry is known for this, right? You get it out the door and then you fix it later, right? Isn't that kind of
absolutely?
It depends. Absolutely. Like most games have a few bugs, from what I've seen. Like Pokemon is like so, yeah.
Right, but Liam, this is a thing, right, Brad? You could speak to this, yeah.
Oh yeah, it's called bug fixes, like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, so there's a financial reason that they do this is they have to ship the games. They have to, like, you know, the games go gold, which means that it's ready to press. Now, what that means, you know, if you go back to my user journey, is nothing. It's just a disc in a case. It's not representative of any finished product. In fact, when they when that game goes gold and they start to ship it to stores, it's not finished. They continue to develop it up to day one and in some cases far after day one.
Oh, yeah.
Julius, you brought up Cyberpunk earlier. Like, that was a game that they were working on. Just to fix it to get it playable for six months or longer after it was actually put on sale, which is a huge debacle.
Yeah, No Man's Sky was another one of those examples game I was really into, and it was just like what got pushed at the beginning was like, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. So it's just weird, you know. You buy these games and you're buying the promise of an experience at some point in the future, as opposed to like something that's done and complete that you can just blow on the cartridge and go.
And to bring it back to Nintendo, I think that that's part of their brand promise is that typically, some exceptions aside, they don't do that. So when they ship a new Mario game, it's going to be done and it's going to be polished. It's going to be super tight. Exactly. And that they do that. That's not part of the brand promise for every one of these manufacturers, but it is for Nintendo.
Yes. Yep. That, I do want to bring up this. People shit on Nintendo a lot for their policies and like, oh, why did this thing get taken out? What is this thing about? In my mind, like Nintendo's policies are what keep them like very together when it comes to manufacturing games. They're both an enemy and like an ally to like the rep of Nintendo. Mm. And in that case, like the company policy for Nintendo is to always ensure quality of their products. And I think that really shows when it comes to like the Joy-Cons. I'm not sure if you're aware of Joy-Con drift, but
I sure am.
That's a thing and it's horrible. But the one thing they do about that is like they do not charge for it. They will fix them for free. And that's
that's right.
Yeah,
Liam, had this experience.
I had this experience. 2020, I had to send it out. They fixed it for free. Mm-hmm. Just ship it, and you're good. And that I think
it's like the that's like the 1-800 number you used to be able to call if your Nintendo broke.
Yeah.
And like,
I don't remember.
It was on the back of every Nintendo instruction.
Of every Nintendo product, it was the Nintendo seal of quality. It was like, you have a problem, let us know.
And I think I've called it. I did call it once when I was a kid.
Yeah,
Liam, that's great. You're bringing us to where this episode is supposed to be. I mean, we're talking about the general UX of gaming. I think Brad, we're now narrowing it down to the consoles themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Do we want to move to PCs now? Or
yeah, so I full transparency, I almost forgot about PCs until Julius brought it up because I was looking at this with a narrow focus of gaming consoles, and I personally don't consider a PC as a gaming console, but for many people they do. I haven't been a PC gamer in years, but I do think that the PC has some significant advantages when it comes to UX over the consoles. And I thought we could talk about why that is. And there's a few different reasons. And the first might be tied to, you know, what I just said. I don't look at it as traditionally a gaming console. A PC is a multitasker. It is a productivity tool. It is something that we all use every day in our professional and personal lives. It has a mouse, which is a far more intuitive input device for navigation. For navigating menus and system menus and options and things like that.
Better for first-person shooters as well.
Now, I can't imagine that that's true, but a lot of people swear to it. So you're saying that it's true? I can't imagine.
Any first-person game, like even Minecraft is better on PC just because of that. Like you don't have to move that analog stick around like the mouse. And honestly, just about it, like, I'm sorry, but like if somehow like Nintendo like made like a Nintendo mouse product, which I'm sure they could with their like innovation mind, like I think they have.
They did for the SNES.
Yeah,
for the
Super Nintendo. I remember that.
Hey, Mario Paint. If they did again, I think that would like up there, like some sort of like input in. And it really sucks that like they did that with the DS and like the touch screen, but they don't have a stylus and stuff for the Switch. So I wonder what their like what their next move is going to be in the realm of that. I don't know.
Yeah,
me too. I think that there's an interesting disparity between a PC and a console, and really not just the console, but the television screen that you're playing the console on. The PC is a very intimate device with a very close and personal connection between the screen and the user with PC again. Like you're literally like inches from the screen. Where on a PC, where like when I'm playing Xbox, I'm in my bed and the screen is 10 feet away. It's a much larger screen, but still, the PC is built for active engagement. That's what you do with a PC. You're interacting with things by design on a PC pretty much all the time, unless you're watching a video. And the television is not built that way. The television is built for passive entertainment. So you're laying back and you are watching something. You are being entertained, and that's how it was designed. You're not really meant to like interact one to one with it that way. So I think that there's some original sin of a UX disconnect between the screen and the user, between how these things are built.
I can speak a little bit to that, just to tie back to the Jurassic Park Camp Cretaceous interactive episode. So
go watch it.
You should watch it. It's on Netflix right now. It's amazing.
Well, I mean, sorry, Julius. Do you say watch or engage?
Watch or play? Right. Yeah. It is an interactive movie where you get to decide, you know, are you going to survive getting eaten by the dinosaurs or not? And it's a hell of a lot of fun. But like what Dragon's you're talking about. Say again, Liam?
Dragon's Lair, the game.
Yes. Yes. It's very much in that kind of vein. But the thing, Brad, that you're talking about is that there are two sets of expectations when it comes to screens, PCs or game consoles versus television. Mm-hmm. And it's called the lean back versus the lean forward experience. Right. So you, at the end of the day, you know, you get a little glass of wine, pop on Netflix. You want to watch something, you want to lean back and be entertained. Right. Mm-hmm. When you're playing a game, whether it's on a game console, you know, you lean in and close to that screen because it's more of an active engagement. There are two completely different mental modes that you're in. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I brought up the Jurassic Park Camp Cretaceous thing is because that sits actually right at the crux between the two of those, because Netflix is a lean back sort of experience. I mean, sure, you go through, you know, the menu and find what it is that you're going to watch. But once you hit that button, you're expecting to be entertained. Mm-hmm. But in some of those interactive experiences, you know, Boss Baby, Bandersnatch, and Camp Cretaceous, at certain points in the narrative, the screen is actually asking you to sit up and make a choice. Mm-hmm. And it's giving you a limited amount of time. So it's like, if you don't choose, you might drive off the cliff or get eaten by the dinosaur or, you know, whichever. So it's an interesting sort of experience where it tells you to switch back and forth between that lean back and lean forward sort of experience. And there was a lot of interesting design challenges and UX challenges around how to make that as smooth as possible. Mm-hmm. But it was really, really, you know, trying to zero in on how do you get the user to interact in the smoothest way to transition between those states.
That's fascinating. I went to an event where they were talking about Bandersnatch, and it was the creators of Bandersnatch, and they were showing, for the users who don't recall, Bandersnatch was the first, I think, interactive Netflix piece of content.
The biggest one. There was there were a couple smaller kids titles before that, but Bandersnatch was the one where they were like, put all of the money and all of the focus on
Minecraft. That. Minecraft, I think, preceded.
A story mode, that game. Oh boy, that was fun.
And that probably says
Bandersnatch was a Black Mirror.
It was Black Mirror.
Yes, it was. Black Mirror episode.
Bandersnatch, was that the one where like it got like a little messed up and it was like a conspiracy of like that guy being in a game? And I think it was something else.
Yeah, yeah.
No, yeah.
Definitely got messed up.
I saw. Yeah. I watched it with you, right? He like has to chop his dad up, which was fun.
Oh,
yeah. One of the choice points was patricide. You're like, oof. Okay.
Yeah. Very fun.
Dark.
Yeah.
But you know, the point I was making is like, you know, they showed the decision matrix for how they built Bandersnatch, mm-hmm. and it's probably similar for Jurassic, Cretaceous. God damn it.
See? Not as easy as you think, Brad.
It's probably similar for what you built, Julius. But it's like it's so multivariate and massive. And when you mm-hmm. visualize the whole thing in a decision tree, a matrix, you know,
yep,
it's super impressive. And I am so, I don't know, that's enamored with this concept and want to pick your brain on how you did this more.
Yes. Same.
But offline.
Yeah. Yeah. Indeed.
Super, super cool stuff. I'm going to keep us moving here. The system navigation on these consoles is different. You know, each of them has their own philosophies of how you navigate through menus and to find content. And what I wanted to say to start with, you know, is that good UX should be designed to get the user where they want to go as quickly as possible, yep. and promote intuitive discoverability. I would say that that's an order of magnitude. But if you're a publisher, there might be, you know, some argument where you would want discoverability to trump getting the user to where they want to go for financial reasons. I.e., you know, as a user, I want to jump into my game quickly, but as a publisher or as Microsoft, I want to make sure that you know there's a new Halo game, that you see that before you jump into your game that you've already paid for.
Yep.
Makes sense, but I would argue that's a little bit short-sighted in terms of, you know, building brands and brand promise and stuff like that.
Why not do it in-game? Why not do it in-game? Posters on the wall as you go by.
Do you want that?
In-game advertising? Wait, no, I think that's...
Yeah, I think it's better. I think it's better. I
mean, it's less intrusive, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, if you're talking about advertising games with other games, like, Smash Bros. A lot... I mentioned Earthbound earlier. Like, I feel like Smash Bros. Introduced a lot of people to Earthbound. It's like...
If I'm not mistaken, there were political campaigns. I don't know if it was the Obama campaign or later.
Animal Crossing campaign,
where they had... campaign ads in the games, which I think is brilliant. I don't have a problem with that.
I think like what is it? I think Biden did like an Animal Crossing island thing, which was funny. He did. Look it up.
So yeah. I think Brad, to answer I think I would prefer that as a gamer to like having to wait for that splash screen. Because I'll tell you, even the beginning, even the stories, and you guys all as gamers can tell me whether you feel this way too, but even the intro stories where you got to sit there and you're tapping and nothing's happening.
Oh, yeah.
And you got to watch this story play out.
And you're just like, skip, please.
You know, I don't even want to see that. And if I don't want to see that as somebody who's waited 8 million, you know, 8 months or a year for this new game to come out, if I'm trying to skip to play, I certainly don't want to see an advertisement.
Yeah, this is a fundamental like antithesis set up between the owner of the system, platform that you're using, the game publishers, and then the actual player. They know why you're there.
Right.
They know that you want to get to the game. They know you really want to get to the game. So they're like, let's frustrate them just enough. But it's not just about pissing you off, right? It is. From a business standpoint, it's almost inevitable. It reminds me of conversations that we used to have back at Disney, Brad, where we were working on the predecessor to Disney Plus, Disney Now,
right.
Which it was this whole thing around, okay, well, if I open up this direct-to-video product, I know where I want to go. I want to watch, let's say, High School Musical or Wizards of Waverly Place or whatever it is, right? Of course, absolutely. But the network wants you to expand your palette and to spend more time so that they can get that average time spent per user up. So they're incentivized to put more stuff in your way. And it's a recommendation engine or editorial or people who watch this also like this. And you're like, get it out of my face. I just want to see the thing. So
this is the constant conflict of building products and product management, building things is like, you know, your KPIs as a designer might not reflect the KPIs of the payer or the organization. Right. In this case, Disney, like when you know, going back to Disney Now, which we worked on, you know, the KPI for the company was linear tune in. To go way back in time. So they didn't care about engagement on the platform so much. Their primary driver of platforms like that back in the day, I don't think it's like this anymore, was getting people to tune in to linear television. What that means is cable. So, you know, Disney Channel. They want to make sure that you know that there's a Wizards of Waverly Place movie that you need to tune in on Tuesday at 7 o'clock to watch. Yep. And that's what they cared about back then. Mm. So that's a conflict between someone who's building the product and someone who's paying for the product. And that's, yep. you know, that's just part of how it goes.
Yeah. It sucks, but yeah. that's what it is.
All right.
We're not at the solutions part yet, but I would, as I mentioned, in-game is fine for me. I don't know if anyone else agrees with that.
No, I don't agree.
And there's some technical pieces there too. Like those screens often are the game itself loading, right? Like, isn't it, so there's some technology here. Like it's kind of like the spinning wheel when mm-hmm. you're on a page and it, you know, or on an app. So it's not all just advertisement and mm-hmm. intentional frustration. I think there's some of it is just.
Right. Well, you brought up loading, which is part of the UX of these games and these consoles, which is poor. So, you know, when we were growing up playing games, there were no loading screens. When they moved to discs, that's when the load screen came around, right? And, you know, 30 years later, there's still tremendous load screens every time we want to play a game. Last generation, I was playing GTA 5, and to load that game on an Xbox One, not the current generation, it might take 3 minutes to freaking load the game. Maybe wow. more. I swear to God, it was such a long ass time.
Well, hang out. Help me here, Brad, because you said the physical disc doesn't include anything. You have to download it. So isn't it then working off of a drive a la kind of like a cartridge? Or is it a physical disc that's spinning? Like, I don't
it's
know.
It's not a physical disc. So it started with a physical disc. That's when the load screen started. So, you could argue that it would make sense if you were loading media from a disc, but we're beyond that now, and it's still a problem.
Okay. Yeah, because cartridges, you plugged into the hardware itself, and it was instant access. It was like loading a flash drive.
Right.
It just was part of the architecture of the system. Once you had the discs have to be loaded up into system RAM. That takes time, and you had that loading thing. And then what Brad is talking about is we're clearly past that now, and yet we still have these insane loading screens where it's now the disc says download from the internet. Right. Because the disc is just the key to Brad's point.
I thought you meant
you bought the game.
I thought you meant after that fact when playing the game.
It's still the same where it's now loading the disc from the system memory, and that's taking time. That is because, you know, all these game makers want to make sure that they're on the bleeding edge of graphics and, you know, technology. And as a result of that, there are always going to be those load times and there's always going to be that friction as long as they're trying to push the boundaries as much as they possibly can. So God of War 4 or God of War Ragnarok that I'm playing on PS4, same thing. I mean, it's got these long ass load times. I imagine on PS5, it wouldn't be as long, but there's still going to be load screens. It's piss poor. But unless people stop buying the games because of that, that's fast forwarding to the end here.
There it is.
It's not going to change. I wanted to get into some specifics on the UX of different systems before we jump into solutions. Here's what I got. There are some commonalities between PlayStation and Nintendo Switch. Specifically, both use a horizontal scroll and, in my opinion, don't take effective advantage of vertical space. What that means is I'll try my best to describe it, is you have a row of content, you know, on the PS4 and I think on the PS5, which I don't own, you can see maybe about 7 or 8 pieces of content. And then you have to navigate to the right to see more. Then you have to navigate the right to see more. And then at the end of that scroll, I can see my library and then I can access all of the content. Some people are fine with that. I find it infuriatingly bad design. By comparison, the Xbox has a more of a vertical column interface, and I can, you know, load that up and I immediately see my library along with my most recent games. And then scrolling down, it's more of, in as few words as possible, they fit a lot more content on the screen, require me to do less inputs to find the content that I'm looking for or that I want to engage with.
Right.
Specifically, a piece of information that I found in our research is that the PS5 requires about 30% more inputs than the Xbox to complete a comparative task.
Wow.
My use case is, you know, I'm using the PS4 to play God of War, and I am plugging in a physical headset because I have a kid, and I want it loud, but I don't want to wake anybody up. So it seems simple enough that I'm going to plug in the headset into the controller with a 3/4-inch jack. But in fact, what I have to do is I have to exit the game. I have to, you know, find the system settings, which requires many steps to get there. Then I have to go to Bluetooth devices audio devices, Then I have to select my headset, and then I have to exit all of that. And then I have to go back to the main menu, and then I have to reselect my game. That is bonkers, right? I mean, what is this insanity? This is the year 2022. What in the world are we doing here?
That's terrible. We haven't even gotten to the game yet.
All this is before I played a game, right?
Right. This is all the preamble to actually playing the game.
Lord,
playing games is not important to this podcast. It's all the other stuff that we're talking about here.
I feel like with that, like you talked about how like there's this like some experiences are like a laid back experiences. Some need to be forward. I feel like honestly, the one thing Nintendo does right is like, well, not the one thing, they do many things right, but like. The thing they do right with that is that they always figure out how to creatively make like an interface that's used like they don't really stick to one particular method of games, but like Xbox and PlayStation, it's always just you have the controller and you have the console and that's what people like, right? So listen in front of your TV. They don't really make use of like creative ways to navigate the interfaces. Like there's no touch.
It's very utilitarian.
And people hate the Wii U all the time, but I think the hate for the Wii U comes from the fact that it's just like it's not what you're expecting. The thing I like about the Wii U is that it's very like it's literally you have a controller, and that controller also has a touchpad on it for use. Like it's a great idea. It's that people just were expecting more of a Switch experience. But in theory, the Wii U is a great idea. Having a controller that also has a touchpad for usage in the game, like that's creative, and it doesn't really interfere with the traditional. Sit on your couch, have a console, and have a controller, play the game on the screen.
Oh, I see what you're saying, Liam. So you're saying what Brad talked about the and Julius talked about having the PC gaming experience where you're there at the keyboard and you're doing things that you traditionally think of as that experience versus kind of the gaming experience. They've kind of merged them.
Yeah.
And people, their brains broke. They somehow didn't like that experience.
They didn't like it because I think it's all because of the fact that they expected, oh, you have a game that you can play on the console and a game that you can play in your hands. And the Nintendo didn't market it. They didn't just market it properly. And people expected something different. That's why they came out with the Switch.
It's funny because I would think you'd want to merge those things and you're offering a new experience. And Julius, just like with your show and Bandersnatch and all these other things, I wonder if similar brain breaking is happening or if we're evolving into like a new state of interactivity and experience. I wish we were. I hope we are because you know?
I think so because this makes me think of just as an analogy, right? Before iPhones landed on the scene, right? Yeah. There were several attempts to try and get at this handheld tablet-esque Newton, you know, all these sorts of things before. And each time it didn't quite work. And even the BlackBerry was like this interesting transitional space where I remember having very heated conversations with people being like, I must have buttons. Like that was a whole,
a
whole thing, right? And now it's like, okay, we've arrived. So the first time, the brain breaks, but I think after 3 or 4 or 5 times or swings at it, it starts to become a little bit more normalized. But it is definitely a transition.
Yeah. Julius, fun fact, I still have a Facebook page called I Hate Virtual Keyboards.
Nice.
Look it up. It's still there. I didn't shut it down.
Did you win? Did you shut down virtual keyboards or are they still out there?
I did not, Brett.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. Let's go on to some current platform solutions. So, you know, I think, you know, to give credit where credit is due, there is some movement, you know, in some of this friction, but probably not enough. I wanted to give a shout out to Xbox Game Pass. It has wonderful UI and discovery and value. I think that going back to the brand promise, that's a key component of Microsoft brand promise, where I think that they're excelling over some competition, as well as cloud gaming, Xbox cloud gaming. So use case here is that I can start to download a game, but I can also play it over the cloud, probably at a lower resolution or lower fidelity than the full thing, but at least I can get going. So cloud gaming, also if we're talking about cloud gaming and gaming consoles and platforms, we have to talk just for a second about Google Stadia, which was a cloud gaming platform that Google
also
announced.
Rest in peace.
Oh, yeah. It's a recurring theme of this podcast. Google comes out with something great and then they kill it. So Stadia was a cloud gaming platform that had no hardware. It had, you know, it was not a physical console at all. It was just gaming on the cloud. And it seemed to work fairly well. They had the technology down, but they didn't have the adoption or they didn't have the will to see it through. And they shut it down earlier this year.
Yep.
PS5 reportedly, again, for the fourth time this episode, I don't have a PS5 because it's impossible to get one. Reportedly, they have reduced load times. So they are treating those load times seriously. I'll believe it when I see it. And Nintendo, still fairly straightforward, less friction, but less technology as well. Smaller games, mm-hmm. smaller game sizes. They seem to mm-hmm. not ship games that are broken for the
usually.
Most part.
Yes.
Usually. anything else that you got? I don't know if you guys are current console gamers, but you know, those are some of the things that I've seen.
Oh yeah, talking about, if you want to talk about discs, and like Nintendo uses cartridges, which is surprising for the Switch. Mm-hmm. Like the cartridges are small. Like, I don't know if that was the move, and I don't know like the benefits of using a disc versus the cartridge, but I mean, I like the cartridges. Having like a full-fledged like sure. game, console game on a cartridge, just this tiny little thing.
It's pretty and neat. It's actually on there. Like, unlike the PS5 or PS4 examples, yeah, it's not a DRM. It's the actual game. Is on
it's the actual
there.
Game.
Yeah. And keep it on. It's pretty cool.
Right on.
So Brad, if I can interject here, we're just talking about the UX of getting into the game. We're not going to get into the UX of playing the game.
I mean, we've talked about the friction of, you know, actually getting in to play a game. Once I'm in the game, I don't have too many complaints.
Okay. All right. I mean, we could talk about buttons and different
menus.
Controllers and oof. Menus.
Let's get into bag management, guys. Come on. Like, ay. Inventory management in games is the bane of my existence. Obviously, it's not for everything, but it's like I'm getting loot. I'm playing games. I'm gathering stuff. And it's like, oh, my bag is full. Now I have to get another bag or I have to throw stuff out. It's like a mini game within the gaming experience. Why is this still a thing? I do not understand.
I think that's where the mouse shines. Like having that mouse is still like, yeah. All that, and even like a keyboard, we have all these different keys that you can use for different like stuff. Can't recreate that with just a controller. And that's why like some solution has to be found, but they're not finding solutions.
Well, I think that you've articulated part of the problem is that I know how these games are created, how they're built, how they're coded. They're coded and built on PCs. So that's your answer right there. So, you know, if you're building a game to use the mouse as an input, but your end result is for a PlayStation. Yeah.
You're going to have a bad time.
There's a disconnect there. There's a huge disconnect there.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's great. I mean, what about the controllers, the physical controllers themselves? Brad, I know this isn't in the script, but like this is the meat and potatoes for me, like actually playing the game. Like, what about the controllers? Like, let's do like you have both the PlayStation and the Nintendo, right? I love it. This is a very narrow experience for me. I love what Nintendo's done. Every time they've done mm-hmm. their thing, I love the Wii controllers. I like what they're doing with the Switch. All, you know, some of it's clunky when you try to play it not with a screen, when they're not clicked together. It gets a little clunky, but I appreciate the ingenuity, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know, what are you guys comparing console controllers? Do you have favorites? Do you have pain points?
It's an interesting thing from my perspective about game controllers, because for non-gamers, modern game controllers are usually like the wall that does not get, does not get crawl. You just don't get past it. It's the barrier to entry that prevents a lot of casual gamers, mm-hmm. I think, from seeing the and experiencing the stuff that's on the other side of that. But then for hardcore gamers who have made it over that interface mm-hmm. wall, like that's very much the thing.
Yeah.
And I think there's a similar bump there for PC gamers versus console gamers as well. Yeah. So it's very, very interesting. Do I have a favorite? I tend towards simpler, but that's because my first gaming console was the Nintendo Entertainment System. You had the Konami code up, down, left, right, A, B, start, select. Like that was it, you know, as in terms of inputs. I saw with the Super, then you had the XY buttons, and then there was more stuff added. And with each successive generation, it got more and more. Yep. I think I topped out really at the Nintendo 64, which had that weird three wing, like you couldn't even hold the controller properly.
It's fun until you have a game where that requires you both to use the D-pad and the stick. Like I had trouble. Yeah, it's kind of intuitive because often some games just use either the D-pad and the buttons or the
either
stick
or,
and the buttons.
But both. Yeah. You're done, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, all these things are problems, but you know, fighting games come to mind, Julius, when you're talking about that. I'm like, mm-hmm. I would love to play fighting games, but you're at a disadvantage when you're a casual gamer, you're playing a serious gamer. They know exactly how to hit all like those 15 buttons at once to like knock your ass out. Right?
I've seen people playing Street Fighter and they have literally those arcade style controllers mm-hmm. that have the joystick and the six buttons. and yeah. they're just going for it. So
oh yes.
I think the more advanced that you get in terms of playing games, the more sophisticated input device that you can kind of master. But again, that's going to be a much, much, much smaller audience. Not everybody is going to get to the competitive level of Smash Brothers or, you know, Street Fighter 2.
Right.
Most people are going to be like my mom, who right. are like, I can do Wii bowling. You know,
yep. Well, that was the genius of the Wii. And it, yeah, it's like yeah. a bell curve here. And mm-hmm. it's pretty crazy to me. And I think that gets into the economics of gaming too. It's yeah. why games cost $70, because I mean, ultimately they are niche. I mean, it's funny to think about, you know, a game, especially a AAA game like Call of Duty, which just raked in $800 million in one day or something crazy yeah. as wow. niche. But they're getting those numbers because they're charging $70. They're leaving a lot of the population behind. As you mentioned, Julius, as the controllers and consoles have increased, there's more and more buttons every goddamn time. There's more buttons this generation than there were two generations ago. And does that mean that there's going to be even more next? I don't know. But I think that there has to be a solution out there that doesn't require you to have 84 buttons to play a game.
I got it, Brad. It's welcome to the metaverse. I think to bring back the power glove. Okay.
To bring back the metaverse is the power glove of 2022.
Exactly. It's true. So once wow. I can do this, okay. And for our users, I'm standing up. Okay,
dude,
I
have put nothing, some pants on.
I have nothing in my hands, and I'm doing a fighting game. Okay, I'm right, yep. right, left, right, left. Yep. I need nothing for that. Once we get that, once we nail that down, and you can control, you can record all that. I think then it's not going to be niche anymore. I think you're going to pull in more people.
I enjoyed the input. I have an Oculus here that I don't play it a whole lot, but right, I did play a couple boxing VR games. Good. And I enjoyed that kind of like, hey, this is very, very intuitive. I think there's other challenges with VR with like you're cutting yourself off from the outside world and hey, I bumped into a wall and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah.
But that seemed to me like an interesting sort of compromise between, you know, having so many buttons and then just something that felt a little more intuitive that you could just jump in and go for it.
Right. Right. Okay.
But, you know, going back to the current, you know, thinking of consoles and how they currently work, a big question is, does it even matter? You know, UX is poor. I think that the four of us can agree, probably most of our users can agree, the UX of these consoles and the experience is pretty poor. Does it matter? I think so. I think so, but like not quite yet. Like, you know, these console makers, game makers are still raking in all this crazy, crazy money, but they're leaving a large percentage of the population behind. So until the dollars are affected, I don't think that this is really going to be fixed.
that's what it is. There's no motivation. It's like, hey, you want to drive a car? Mm-hmm. You're going to go to the DMV. And it's gonna suck. What are you gonna do, not drive a car?
For sure.
I will say it doesn't all suck. I mean, these are amazing things that we're doing, right? Like when I was a kid, like that ET game was hot garbage, right? Sure. Like, you know, Pong, that was fun. But that was, you know, I mean, pixels on a screen bouncing back and forth. So we gotta at least tip our hat to how amazing these experiences are, especially when we get into the VR world and all this stuff.
Yeah, the technology has increased, but the focus on UX design has not caught up with the technology. So that's the disconnect.
I think that you're spot on with that, Brad. This whole topic made me think of a book that I read many years ago called The Innovator's Solution, which was the sequel to The Innovator's Dilemma.
I read that one.
Right. Which described this whole process within the market in which you have established market leaders who kind of have cornered the market and they are not innovating anymore.
Right.
And they're very established. And then a disruptor comes along with a substandard product, not nearly as good at all, but it's easier. Mm. Right. And then the incumbents go, get out of here with that garbage. Did it. So it's like, this is Canon DSLRs versus iPhone cameras. This is
so perfect,
right? Yeah. Where it's like, well, we're just going to go towards the higher end and we're going to get more boutique and higher, nicer lenses and bigger CMOS things. Mm-hmm. And just with each successive generation, iPhone cameras just got a little bit better and better and better until suddenly they push the incumbents off the cliff,
right?
Because it's just an easier technology and it's good enough. I have a DSLR in this desk that I have not used in 6 years because I've had the iPhone camera, and you know what? It's good enough. And at a certain point, it got better. And I think what's going to happen, or not necessarily what's going to happen, but what the opportunity is for a disruptor to come in might be, is to start putting together some gaming experiences that maybe are a little bit more complex than the casual gaming experience. Mm-hmm. Maybe appeals a little bit to the hardcore gamer who might be playing the God of War, right? Or the Destiny 2 or that. And maybe the hardcore gamer will spend most of their time going through their favorite IP. But then when they're done, this is good enough.
Yep.
When that happens, that is the bellwether for the end, because that's an opportunity for a disruptor to say, let's make this user experience a little bit smoother. Let's get a lot of people who are not hardcore gamers into this experience. And then suddenly you're going to see those $800 million Call of Duty numbers start to go down. But we're not there yet.
But when it does happen, it happens quick. Clayton Christensen, the author of Inventor's Dilemma and The Innovator's Solution, which I haven't read, but I've read the first one. What he describes is that there is like a moment where it's good enough, and that's like a snap of a finger.
Yep.
And we've seen that in the past. And that, I mean, it certainly could happen again to these console makers, where somebody's going to come around and it's going to be just good enough. And then all of a sudden, that's going to be all it takes to disrupt and change
destroy
an entire industry, you know? Yep. So I do think, I think that's likely. I mean, it's just how technology works. Julius, you put a comment in the script that I thought was maybe a really apt way to close out this discussion today. With your permission, you mind if I read it?
No, go for it.
Okay. You said, as a teenager, I could perhaps have been described as a hardcore gamer, but as the market has matured, it's clear that I no longer fit that user persona. I think this is the core of a lot of UX friction we'll be discussing today. I'm just not enough of a fan of video games to put up with all the nonsense it takes to play.
Ooh.
Perfectly said. I mean,
I could have written that. That's exactly how I feel, Julius. Seriously.
You could have written it, but not as well.
That's right. If I had, I would be following Julius's career path. Which is also my hope and dream. But yeah, no, all seriousness, you hit the nail on the head, Julius, because it's like I look at my son's Nintendo Switch all the time, and I'm like, I want to do that, right? Like, I'm thinking, okay, I've got laundry to fold, I got this to do, I got work to do, and I'm like, yeah, but I just want to do this for 5 minutes. But I know it's not 5 minutes. And I know I'm going to have to run to him and go, hey, what is that A, B, up, down, left, control, under, where's the, there's so many. And then it's just like, forget it. It's not even worth it.
Yeah, you throw up your hands. You're just like, nah, forget it. Do something else.
Yeah.
There's a lot more competition for our eyeballs today, too.
It's how I always look at it. Like, the difference between playing video games and gaming. Like, there's definitely a difference there. And I always like to say, like, I'm a video game player, not so much a gamer, because I do enjoy that more open casual gaming experience that's easy to learn, easy to pick up, and you don't need to take so long to master. Or on the other hand, have a game that like eases you into it, just assumes you don't know all the button controls and combinations, and just sort of like somehow creates that gap or is open enough for a simple player to understand it, but like a hardcore player to still have fun with it and get into it.
So teaching you the UX.
Exactly. Like having a game that really teaches the controls well and eases you in as you play. And it's easy to pick up. Now, that's something that I think should be strived for.
That's a good note.
So, Liam, there's this great article on Super Mario Brothers, the first one, and how it does exactly what you're describing as like a complete masterclass and easing you along and teaching you just what you need to know when you need to know it. I'll send that to you because I think you'll find it really interesting. I'll also put in the episode notes for anyone who's interested.
Cool.
Highly recommend reading it. Liam Walsh, thank you for joining.
You're very welcome.
Julius Harper, Mr. Cole, thank you for joining.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me, too.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for a great discussion. And to our users and our listeners, please remember to subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts if you could. We'd really appreciate it. And in the meantime, we're wishing you all health, a well-designed life, and good experiences.
Yeah, if you put the The boob reel. I need to get some of that Patreon money. You know. I mean, listen, man. I'm all up for having stuff.
This kid knows what's up.
My reputation. I can tarnish it, but I need to have some money from that because it is worth.
Smart.
It really is.
We'll give you an equity stake, son. And it's not gonna be hard cash. You know, we're not liquid yet. That's true.